Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 144, Psychoanalysis from Both Sides of the Couch, March 21st, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I also think there's been a huge shift in psychoanalysis itself, which I'm sure the public doesn't know about. Classical psychoanalysis, as it developed in this country, not as Freud practiced it and not as people practiced it in Europe or other countries, became very antiseptic to the point that it really wasn't a two-way process. There was the analyst, the patient lying on the couch, and the analyst interpreting the patient, his behavior, as if the analyst had nothing else to do but to make interpretations. And everybody nowadays, whether you're a contemporary Freudian, which I consider myself, or a relational or interpersonal, acknowledges that the analyst being in the room with the patient, having feelings, reactions, thoughts, is a part of the process.
That was the voice of my guest, Fern Cohen, Ph.D., Fern W. Cohen, Ph.D., is a psychoanalyst and psychotherapist in private practice in New York City and has long been committed to conveying in everyday language what the psychoanalytic process is about and how it works. She's the author of the 2007 book, From Both Sides of the Couch, Reflections of a Psychoanalyst, Daughter, Tennis Player, and Other Selves. A graduate of Radcliffe College, Dr. Cohen earned her Ph.D. in school psychology from New York University and completed her analytic training at the NYU postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, as well as the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, of which she is a member. When she's not playing tennis, hanging out with her grandchildren, or mastering music for two pianos, she's practicing psychoanalysis in New York City. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Fern Cohen, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Wonderful. Well, first of all, allow me to congratulate you on writing such a personal, revealing, and educational memoir. You pack a lot into 191 very readable and engaging pages.
Well, thank you. It was not what I set out to write. In fact, when I first began to write in this voice and in this style, I had no idea that I was going to write a book.
But what did you set out to write?
Well, I was back in analysis, which I had actually started as what I thought was going to be psychotherapy to help me with some of the issues that were coming up in my work. And I was just catapulted into this very intense experience. And I began to write. I mean, I've always written to the extent that I, you know, learned to write papers, I write thank you notes, but I've never written autobiographical essays or anything that was internally propelled. And after a period of keeping this intense journal, I just had this experience that I would get a sentence would come to mind, and I'd write it down, and the next thing I knew, I had a paragraph. And the first piece I wrote in that vein was about our youngest child going off to college and the sense of loss and his coming home with a duffel of laundry, which I interpreted as a older version of a pink pillow he had had as a small child. And then I ended up writing about a patient, again, a very personal experience, not so much about a theoretically driven paper. And then an essay about my piano teacher from my childhood, and there was this essay which I called 40 Love, Reflections of a Tennis Player, Daughter, and Other Selves, which is still in the title of the book, but now as a subtitle. And it was a long essay. A lot of the material in the essay was the same that ended up in the book. And I sent a bunch of essays to an agent who suggested that I turn the tennis piece into a book. And I didn't know at that point that you don't take an essay and expand it like an accordion and turn it into a book, which is what I did.
Yeah.
And that was about 15, maybe 18 years ago. And over the years, I sent it out to some people. I had encouragement. I knew I needed an editor. And over time, I mean, I finally found an editor. There were times when I would leave the book and I would think it was dead. And then I would discover that it was dormant and I would get back to it while I was writing other things. And I hooked up with an editor about 4 years ago, whom I acknowledge in the book, a woman by the name of Cindy Hyden. And we just clicked, and I spent about 2 years editing, rewriting. And what had happened in the intervening years, and this is where the connection to analysis as a freeing process, instead of the first version, which had very much the voice of a daughter who could never really connect to her father and wanted him to know who she was, I had become an analyst. I had also become more confident about myself and who I was. And so the voice of the book is really me speaking with more confidence about analysis, my work, and, you know, throwing that light also on the power of our earliest relationships, which in my case was so much shaped by a legendary father. So that's a long-winded answer, but it really is the book that is now, which is so interesting to me, is how much of the material is the same, but the voice and the structure too, which just evolved with a lot of work, is quite different.
Yes, at first when you started talking about it, I thought, oh, what an easy way to write a book. but as you've gone on, I see it was quite a long and in some ways torturous process.
Well, it was an odyssey, and at some point in the last 5 years before I really began to work with an editor and had the sense that it was really going to become a book that I would want to have published, I used to refer to it as the beast.
I can understand that.
Yeah, so it was definitely for a while, you know, a beast.
Yes. Well, I want to let our listeners in a little bit more about this book, because I've read it and they haven't, or I've read quite a bit in it and they haven't. So just to amplify a little bit of what you've already hinted at, you grew up with a father who I guess was an extremely successful and very well-known lawyer. And this had a powerful imprint on your young psyche, and in many ways the difficulties of that relationship got expressed in your tennis game, and you've been a passionate tennis player all your life. So maybe you can say a little, and the book has three major sections, so maybe you can say a little bit more about the structure of the book and the focus of those three sections.
Okay, just to backtrack a little bit, and the first section is, I call it mostly about my father, and I do really try to capture the ways in which our earliest figures, we call them in the trade objects, which is such an inanimate term for such an important human relationship.
Oh, I've often just felt that it's a shockingly bad term, but go ahead.
Terrible.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's like ego, translated from the German, doesn't capture any of what Freud meant when he talked about the self and even sometimes the soul.
Yes.
So I quite agree with you about object. But mine was my father, and he was, you said lawyer, and it's true he was a lawyer, but he became a federal judge when I was in high school, and that's where the legend really began. I mean, he was always a workaholic. I mean, I remember as a child when he was working on a case, you know, he wouldn't come home till very late, and it consumed him. And that was a very important influence on me, because growing up, I felt that anything other than that was wrong. You know, if you didn't devote yourself 200% to whatever you were doing, it couldn't be good, and you couldn't be good enough. And so that shaped me, and the reason tennis became such a passion is my father had very few relaxations, but tennis was one of them. And when I was about 6 or 7, he would take me up to the tennis courts when he played with a friend, and between sets, he'd pitch a few balls to me, and that was when I got hooked. It was a link to him, it was something he loved, and I loved it and him. And, of course, in the fantasy version, which I was not aware of at all, that could allow me to be close to him.
Yes.
In truth, I never really played with him. I mean, he never took me to the courts to teach me. He played with a friend, and I was, you know, the sort of the pause between the sets. But it did become my passion, but it also became for me a playing field where I could play out a lot of the conflicts that I had inherited from him. For instance, he used to say, winning doesn't matter. It's important to do the best you can. And while I think in many ways that is a very admirable goal, to do the best you can, it's sort of amorphous, and if you're doing the best you can but you're losing, how do you justify the bad feelings that come with losing? Because I had plenty of bad feelings about losing, as people do, but they filled me with shame, because in this ideal version, it shouldn't matter. One wasn't supposed to lose one's temper or be aggressive, and all the aggressive things that got stirred up in me playing when I was faced with loss always felt... Well, sinful is too strong a word, but they certainly made me feel ashamed of myself. And a lot of the things that I inherited from this paragon of a man felt that I was wrong because I couldn't handle them the way he did. And he did live the way he spoke. I mean, aside from the long work hours, he believed, and I think he practiced, which is something that makes me really miss him. He felt that every case that he tried was important, whether it was a small, you know, individual or a huge corporation or a famous person, and he devoted the same time and energy and diligence to each case. And he had a kind of integrity that I think is very rare in general, but is certainly lacking in today's society. So I miss that about him, but I didn't feel that I was like that myself and I could live that way. And so the comparison with him always made one feel lesser than and smaller.
There's something kind of archetypal there, isn't there, for people who are the children of parents who are famous or successful in a particular way, that often there's a struggle there to come to terms with that?
Oh, I think very much so. And the sense of, you know, when somebody has such high status in the public eye, even if they're different, you know, at home, although the odd thing was my father wasn't different at home, it makes the comparison, especially when you're small, and that's when you really form these feelings and sense of self, you know, in the small moments and in the daily interactions. And so it's very hard to feel that if you're different and maybe not famous or not admired in that way, you could still be adequate or know something. So, and I think children of famous parents often do have that experience. Although I think in the larger world, my father certainly was not famous, you know, or well-known. I think kids of really famous parents have a whole other dimension to struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
But he was admired in the legal world, and, you know, the Chief Justice called him a judge's judge. And it was legitimate, but it was also awe-inspiring.
Yes. Well, you write beautifully about, and in sometimes in kind of minute detail, not in any way boringly minute detail, but really in an analytic way, kind of appreciative of the many ways in which the strong feelings that you had for him and the emotions that you were struggling with, mm-hmm. and how those expressed themselves in your game of tennis, mm. and how important it was for you to win, and how you felt when you lost, and how you discovered that you couldn't let yourself go all the way. There was something that was holding you back at the same time.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, in some ways, that is the way one works as a psychoanalyst. That it's the small details, the small omissions, the slip of the tongue, you know, to pick a more obvious example. It's the everyday things around us that we invest with meaning, sometimes from our past, making them more powerful or, you know, trying to avoid them. And I'm happy if I've succeeded in showing that the way to understand the world is in these small things, because that's where the answers really lie for us. I mean, I think ideas, convictions are important, but I think it's the everyday things that we are compelled to do, or we are compelled to avoid, or we seek in order to repair. It comes out in the tennis court, it comes out, you know, on the job, it comes out all over the place if one knows how to pay attention.
Yes, and you know, the book is titled From Both Sides of the Couch, and I think that's the beauty of it, is that you are both a working psychoanalyst and you went through your own psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. and so it gives a person kind of an inside window into that experience from both sides of the couch. So we've touched upon the first part of the book, which is very much about your relationship with your father and how it affected you throughout your life and affected you particularly in relation to tennis. Let's talk about parts two and three a bit. How would you characterize those for our listeners?
Well, part two, the middle part, maybe it will help to backtrack. I mentioned the structure of the book, which changed. At some point when I was in the home stretch but hadn't quite worked out the structure, I had all this material but it was in different places, I actually had an image of a figure eight on its side, if you can imagine the intersection in the middle. And the middle, the first section is about me and my father and my growing up, but certainly more about him. The intersection is about psychoanalysis. It's about the process, examples of how it helped me, what I learned, and actually how it works. And I'm very specific, you know, like the issue of frequency, the issue of who can be a psychoanalyst, the issue of training, and I also give examples from my own work, often to illustrate a similar point that I've made about myself. And I think in some ways that's the book that I wrote for my father, because my passion, and I think I say this in the bio, my passion really is for the public to understand what it is, how it might benefit them, and, of course, not to dismiss it in the way that I think so many people do nowadays.
Yes, I want to get into that.
Yeah, but I think the original person for whom the book was written was my father. So in telling people who I am, what I do, why I believe in psychoanalysis, I do I think a lot of what we do as adults have its roots in some person or some experience in our childhood. And so my father is the first person whom I would have wanted to read the book and I hope would have understood. I'm not sure.
He had already passed on by the time the book
was
done.
Yes, he died about, I guess now it's about 12 years ago. And it's interesting that you say that. Somebody asked me not so long ago whether I would have published the book if my father and mother were still alive, but particularly my father. And, you know, I'm not sure I would have. I would hope he would understand the role that he played and how much he meant to me, but that was the great loss for me, is that he really couldn't step out of rational mind. And it laid the seeds for me to want other people to know. But originally it was him, now it's the public, because I hate the fact that people are so clueless about a good psychotherapy or a good psychoanalysis and dismiss it or make fun of it.
I love the phrase you just used, step out of rational mind. The ability to step out of rational mind. That sounds like a phrase that's pregnant with meaning.
Well, we have two modes of thinking. Well, we have many modes of thinking. But, you know, when we're very small, we don't really think in rational mind. We think in images and feelings, and even before we have words to put to them. And, you know, acquiring, and we call it primary process, which is where there are fantasies, there are wishes, the small child's anger that becomes a thought, I hate you, I wish you were dead, to a parent, becomes very frightening because they don't, you know, distinguish between the thought and the deed. In that sense, very Catholic, with a capital C. But my father couldn't enter the world of the unrational. I mean, he was reasonable. He felt not only you do the best you can, if you have a problem, you just struggle with it, but there was no room for the imaginative leap or the panic of, I'm scared, I can't do this, and understanding that it might be coming from someplace else. And it was his great limitation, because he couldn't enter the mind of a child or really relate to childish anxieties or fears. And it was what, you know, I experienced. And I didn't know that that was something that I was missing until I went to college. I mean, I really grew up idealizing him, thinking that his way was the way I should be when I was an adult, and really didn't discover that there were other forces inside me as well as in everybody else until I got to college and I fell apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me have you touch on part three of the book, and then I'll come back and we'll talk about psychoanalysis some more.
Yeah. Well, part three is actually more back to me. It's still also about psychoanalysis, because actually psychoanalysis runs through the entire book, even though the focus is different in the different parts. And that one goes even further back to my childhood and some of the experiences that I remember that I think capture what was wrong and what was missing. And it also brings the reader up to date, post-analysis anyway, post my first analysis after I was in college, that I was freed up enough to find and marry a very different kind of man from my father. I mean, I really knew by that time I didn't want to be excluded from the important part of my husband's life. In my father's case, it was his work. I didn't want to become a lawyer, which would have been a way to join my father, but I knew that I wanted to be married to somebody who put family before work, and I was very lucky in that regard. So some of the story in part three is actually about a happy ending. Because for me, I consider that I was very lucky to have had enough tools from analysis to be able to separate from choosing somebody like my father. But it also goes back to another crucial missing ingredient of my childhood, and that was the emotional unavailability of my mother. And if children don't have that, then they're missing something that's even more important than what a father has to offer, which is often an opportunity to separate from a mother. I mean, sometimes a good mother is hard to give up. I mean, why should we? They take care of us, they love us, they limit set appropriately. So one of the tasks of growing up is to have the experience of being understood and taken care of, and then start to be able to separate to do it on one's own. And I think it's what made my father so much more important to me, that she was attractive, she was pleasant, she could be very charming, but when it came to, you know, really tuning in to children or being available in that sense, it just wasn't there.
Yes.
So there's a lot about that and the importance of certain aspects of mothering that, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, children can get, because it helps them have a very good foundation about themselves and who they are.
Yes. Now, clearly, psychoanalysis, as you've indicated, has played a major role in your life. I think in the course of reading it, I have the impression that you went through three different psychoanalyses yourself, and then you became an analyst yourself.
Right.
Yet both Freud and psychoanalysis get a very bad rap on most university and college campuses these days. Why do you think that is?
Oh, that's a really hard question. The first answer that comes to mind, and I think this is also very cultural, we do live in an era of the quick fix, celebrity, hype, and psychoanalysis or intensive psychotherapy is very labor intensive. It can be very expensive. I think there are ways, if people know what it is and want it, there are definitely ways that people can have a psychoanalysis and not have to pay the expenses. But I think that certainly is part of it. People want a quicker fix. I think we live in an era when, you know, from my perspective, we're in an epidemic of medication and over-medication. People go to their internist and say, I'm depressed, and they give them some Prozac. I mean, they don't even bother going to a psychopharmacologist. They go to a psychopharmacologist, and they say, I'm sad or depressed, and there's I'm not saying this is true of, the really thoughtful, competent ones, but I think the majority just dole out pills. And it doesn't solve whatever it is that's precipitating, you know, the particular feeling. And, of course, the crisis in healthcare. I mean, we have insurance companies who determine the frequency of treatments that they will reimburse or the number of sessions per year. And working on something that's an old deep-seated source of anxiety or poor self-esteem isn't going to get better in 52 sessions. I mean, it could take 3 years, 4 years, 2 years. So there are a lot of external things that's certainly a part of it. I also think there's been a huge shift in psychoanalysis itself, which I'm sure the public doesn't know about. Classical psychoanalysis, and I do write about this in the book, as it developed in this country, not as Freud practiced it and not as people practiced it in Europe or other countries, became very antiseptic to the point that it really wasn't a two-way process. There was the analyst, the patient lying on the couch, and the analyst interpreting the patient, his behavior, as if the analyst had nothing else to do but to make interpretations. And everybody nowadays, whether you're a contemporary Freudian, which I consider myself, or a relational or interpersonal, acknowledges that the analyst being in the room with the patient, having feelings, reactions, thoughts, is a part of the process. So I think for people who don't know about that shift, thinking about the sort of antiseptic Woody Allen model that went on forever and ever, it's not a very desirable process to think about, I would think. So those are two things that I think probably contributing.
In the book in particular, you comment on the contributions of Melanie Klein and also D.W. Winnicott. Maybe you could briefly comment on their contributions.
Well, both of them, Melanie Klein, who was actually in competition with Anna Freud, the two daughters after Freud died, really brought psychoanalysis much back to what we call the pre-Oedipal period. I mean, I think to have the perspective, Freud really focused on the Oedipal conflict, which he thought, you know, began around 4 or 5 and came to its height at 6. And at the end of that, the Oedipal period being when the boy is in love with his mother and competes with his father. This always sounds so sort of corny, but it does happen, except not so blatantly. And the boy has to renounce his mother and identify with his father, and I mean, there's a lot more to that. But and Freud acknowledged the importance of the mother, but he didn't pay a lot of attention to what went on between mother and baby and how babies develop a sense of self and what happens to the drives that he postulated. So one of the things Melanie Klein did is really turn the spotlight on the infant and the mind of the infant, which she hypothesized had very aggressive, destructive fantasies towards the mother, envying the mother, and how the mind of the infant, what happened. Things like what she called splitting, where the infant had an image of a good mother and a bad mother, but somehow couldn't integrate you know, the way mothers really are. They have a little good stuff and a little bad stuff, and we might have angry feelings, but they're still a good enough mother. And I think it was a very important shift, because in bringing the mother in and the relations between the two, she also created a sense of a dyadic process. And in many ways, that is what happens in psychoanalysis. It is a dyadic process, although the patient or analysand is still the center of the process, acknowledging that the analyst has a role to either receive or to hold or to contain is very different from the early practice of psychoanalysis. And Winnicott took it further. I mean, he said, without a baby, you don't have a mother. And without a mother, you can't have a baby. So he implied, you know, the dyadic element from the very beginning. And I think a lot of that is what has helped the shift in you know, one's in my and analyst perception of what goes on between analyst and an alisand. You know, I say someplace in my book, and this is a more general way of saying, describing some of what I've just touched on, it's an opportunity to be reparented in a benevolent way. And I go on to clarify, I don't mean reparented as if the analyst becomes a parent, because you're not the parent and you can't. You shouldn't try to replace the parent. But the emotional feelings that get stirred up or have gone awry have an opportunity to come out in the process and to be repaired. So I don't know whether that clarifies it, but I think it's a much more emotionally intense experience than it could have been in the earlier model when the analyst was really quite removed. And for me, in my first analysis, the analyst was the authority, who of course became a version of my father in the transference.
Yes, there's a lot of good discussion in your book about the sort of the older blank screen model,
mm-hmm.
And I guess contemporary practice, the analyst is somewhat more available. There's a recognition that nobody can be a truly blank screen.
There should be, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is different from being neutral. I mean, you said we're going to save discussions about the treatment perhaps for another conversation.
Yes.
But that's, you know, one thing that Paul, the therapist, leans over from my perspective too far in the other direction, because he has a lot of self-disclosure. Last night in the session with Sophie, which I think are the best ones in the whole series, Sophie talks about a nightmare that she has, and instead of staying with her in the nightmare, he tells her about his recurring nightmare when he was a child, which I couldn't quite see the point of it.
Yeah.
I mean, she was already, you know, getting on with it, and he then picked up the threads and got back to her, but it seemed to me that was an intrusion and totally unnecessary.
I do want to have that conversation with you, and I'm going to postpone it because there's so much that we can talk about there, and there's so much that it illustrates about analysis and other approaches to psychotherapy that I think we can have a really rich conversation about that. So I'm going to table it for now because you and I had originally planned that we would talk about in treatment. But there's so much else for us to focus on. So you've kindly consented to a follow-up interview, which we will definitely do. So bringing us back to the couch.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, I said to you earlier, I'm always happy to expand.
Yeah.
You have to remember I was a kid in the bedroom who never got to talk. So.
Okay. Well, you just mentioned Sophie's nightmare. What's the role of dreams in your particular approach? Because I'm particularly interested in dreams, and I'm wondering, you know, some people put more emphasis on them and others less. What role do dreams play for you?
Well, I always have this guilty sense that I should let them play more. But for me, I'm not as comfortable with dreams as other means of picking up clues. I mean, obviously I do analyze them when patients bring them. I think it gets us to an interesting point about psychoanalysis and psychoanalysts and therapists. And this was very hard for me to learn about myself and accept. I think analysts have different styles and temperaments. And I know analysts, I mean, some of my friends, are really into dreams and get very excited, you know, when a dream comes up and see it as Freud did, originally, the royal road to the unconscious. But there are many roads to the unconscious, and I think that's one of the amazing things about the process is that you can get to the unconscious in a variety of ways, and it depends on the particular patient, and I think it depends on the particular analyst. And I think in a good treatment, someone will get to all the issues that, you know, he or she needs to deal with. But even the gender of a therapist may determine which issues come up first and which come up later.
But ideally, it'll all come out in the wash, though.
Ideally, it will all come out in the wash, although I think there are always little pockets that, one may not get to.
Yes, and you illustrate that in your book, because with the three different therapists that you went to, you discovered that there were pockets that had been left.
Yeah, big pockets.
Big pockets.
As I say in the book, I really consider the first two the same analysis. In my mind, I've sort of telescoped them together, because one was in college, which really grew out of my having fallen apart in a bout with anorexia, and it really introduced me to why I had fallen apart and what that I had an unconscious. And I ended it too soon. And I think in those days, analyses were much shorter. And I didn't want to end it. I got a job in New York, and my analyst thought I was ready, you know, to terminate the analysis. But it was very clear after about a year and a half that I had left stuff undone. So I ended up in another one. But I think in some ways I have tended to think of them as, you know, my first analyses.
Yeah. Well, as we begin to wind things down here, let me come back to, you know, who is analysis good for? I mean, from a certain point of view, I mean, I agree with you that insurance companies are insisting upon and driving us towards the quick fix. On the other hand, it's understandable that they wouldn't want to pay for 4 or 5 years of analysis. So who is psychoanalysis good for? It is expensive and time-consuming. It's valuable, but is it a bit of a luxury, maybe?
Well, yes, it is a luxury. But as I, you know, have said in my book, it could be a luxury, but also, if so, is to clap its hands and sing, quoting from Yeats. I mean, what comes to mind is, and this is in the book too, a young man I worked with who came in crisis because he had been married for a year, separated from his wife because he found it unbearable, because he felt that he had married a version of his mother, which he had, a very dependent, helpless woman. And as we began to work, it was quite clear how impaired his self-esteem was. I mean, he was very functional. He had a, you know, tough job in a very competitive industry. And his relationships were very shallow, and he was terrified of any in-depth connection. That residual had to do with his mother was suicidal, depressed, and he felt that he was the cause of the depression and her being suicidal. So he was resentful at having to take care of her, but at the same time he thought he was too dangerous. And that kind of old history takes a lot of therapeutic work. I mean, I wish there were a faster way, but he ended the treatment after about 3 years, partly because the insurance company stopped paying, and the adjuster had said, well, he's one of the walking wounded, we don't reimburse for that. But my sense of his capacity to have an in-depth, intimate relationship had not yet grown, and I am doubtful that it would. So, from one perspective, you're right, it's a luxury because he is a very functional human being. But I think there are a lot of functional human beings who have all kinds of injuries, self-destructive tendencies. I mean, look at Elliot Spitzer. I mean, to pick the most current example.
Yes.
I don't understand what makes him tick, but I think people have demons, and they can function very well in the world, but it doesn't mean they couldn't live more gratifying lives and also, you know, not do so much damage to the people with whom they're involved. For me, it's not an answerable question. For me, it's about trying to encourage people to know of the possibility and that there are ways to try to, you know, find treatment at the same time that I agree with you. It's, you know, expensive, time-consuming.
You did allude to the possibility that there are ways to find ways to do it more affordably. I think you were alluding to that.
Well, for one thing, you know, there are, but this is only in the big cities. I mean, there are training institutes. I mean, New York is not a good example because New York is, you know, has so many training institutes. But, you know, the other coast, Michigan, there are places in the country like Kansas. But I do think people can get affordable treatment by, you know, going to somebody who is in training at an institute. What has started to happen, you know, more, and there's a lot of debate about it, is sometimes people have been having phone sessions. So if there is some kind of a connection with a therapist, it's not impossible to have phone sessions, although it's not ideal. A lot of things aren't. And I think it's always important for people, wherever they are, to ask about training, because to spend time in therapy with somebody who isn't trained could be harmful. I mean, I have a couple of instances of patients who were in treatment with just outrageous therapists who spent a lot of years undoing damage before they could begin to, you know, sort of pick up where they might have started before.
Mm-hmm. To provide a little bit more context for listeners, too, I should mention that when we talk about psychoanalysis, you're pretty clear in your book that when you talk about analysis, distinguishing it from what might be called psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy, real analysis, you say, is three times a week minimally, and ideally five times a week.
Yes. The five times a week, as you can imagine, is increasingly rare. And three times a week, from my perspective, is a compromise. However, there are many contemporary analysts for whom three times a week is fine, but I don't consider once a week or twice a week an analysis, because the transference to the analyst can't develop that intensely with twice a week. I mean, there is something about the frequency that facilitates the attachment, and that's what you want, because you want to become the object of their love as well as their hate. I mean, people always joke about falling in love with the analyst, but they don't remember that they, you know, are often the object of the hate, which is the right place for it to get worked through.
And that takes me back to In Treatment, because we really get to see that piece of it illustrated in Treatment quite a bit. But we'll save that for our next conversation. So I probably should close it off here, although I'm reluctant to do so, because I had a lot more topics that were stimulated by your book that I wanted to discuss with you. But
do I have a minute?
Yes, yes.
You talked about, I said labor intensive, and it reminds me of, we have a house in the country in the western foothills of the Catskills, and a number of years ago a neighbor came to us and said, my buddy is giving away his maple syrup equipment, could we tap your trees and boil the syrup on your property? So we ended up with this maple syrup project. We, of course, didn't really do the labor because we were only up on the weekends. But it takes, I don't know whether you know anything about maple syrup, it takes 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of maple syrup.
Uh-huh.
It is the most labor-intensive process that I know of, except for an analysis.
Okay.
And the maple syrup that you get is sublime. I'm not sure I could take the parallel quite that far, but it is labor-intensive. There's no question about it, but it doesn't mean it's not worthwhile trying or thinking that one might want to try that for oneself.
Okay, well, Dr. Fern Cohen, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio, and I'm looking forward to talking with you again soon.
Well, I am too, and I thank you so much for the opportunity, because I do think it's an opportunity, and thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Fern Cohen. There were a number of psychoanalytic topics I had hoped to explore with her, but we ran out of time. However, I have scheduled a follow-up interview with her, which will follow close on the heels of this one. And there's some homework for you to do to get ready for that. We're going to discuss our reactions to the HBO television series In Treatment. This is an American adaptation of an extremely popular award-winning series from Israel. The American version has generated similar interest over here with write-ups in the New York Times and other major periodicals. It's created a lot of buzz, particularly among psychoanalysts and psychotherapists, because the depiction of psychotherapy and the psychotherapist, at least in the initial episodes, is one of the best to ever appear in the popular media. Certainly, that's my opinion. I'm afraid as the series has gone on, though, it's devolved somewhat more into a soap opera and gone in directions that I think are less likely to be typical of an actual psychotherapist. Now, I realize that not all of my listeners have access to HBO, but presumably you all have access to iTunes. You can get the first 15 episodes for free in the iTunes store. If you don't have iTunes on your computer, you can download it for free. Then go to the iTunes store and do a search for In Treatment. So this is your homework. Listen to these free in-treatment episodes so that you can get the most out of my follow-up session with Dr. Fern Cohen. Be there or be square.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
As I've mentioned before, I'm going to be in Barcelona in early May, and I'd love to meet with one or more of you there. So if you are in or around Barcelona, let me know. Maybe we could get together for a coffee or something, or you could give me some tourist tips. We haven't had an addition to our Frapper map in so long, I'm beginning to wonder if we've hit some sort of upper limit or barrier on how many people they allow. Help me test that out. If you're not on our map, please add yourself. You'll find a link on our site. And if you haven't noticed, there are also T-shirts with the Shrink Wrap Radio logo that can be purchased on our website. I don't make any money off these, but I like the idea of you wearing one. The sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy. Podshow has changed their look and feel. You might want to check them out at podshow.com. And thanks to all of you who have bought domain names and such at GoDaddy and used the discount codes on our Shrink Wrap Radio website, for example, Shrink1, Shrink2, and Shrink3. You'll find each of those codes described on our website. And these discounted purchases also help to support this show.
What's up, Dr. Dave? It's Nathan Rice calling you out of Brooklyn, New York. And I'm just calling to say I love your show. I've been listening to it while I work out. It's a great way to stay intellectually stimulated. And I'm going to keep listening. And I put a plug on my website called changemaven.com. And I just put a post talking about your show, so hopefully other people will start listening to it too. Keep up the good work.
Nathan Rice, thanks so much for that ringing endorsement. I did go to your blog site at www.changemaven.com, and I love the recommendation you posted there. I recommend Nathan's blog to the rest of you, and I also encourage you to send your own voice messages using the My Chingo button on our website, as Nathan did. However, My Chingo is not the only way to leave messages. You can also use the phone number that I give at the end of each show, as the next listener did.
Hey, Dr. Dave, I just want to let you know how much I appreciate your show. My name's Rick Vail, and I'm an undergraduate student in psychology at San Diego State University. But I'm an older student. I'm 44, and I was wondering if you wouldn't mind doing a show on older students returning to university. And I actually am going to get my PhD. I'm a junior at this point, so I've got a ways to go. But when I'm done, I'll be considerably older. So, and also, I'd be interested in hearing a show on Institutional Review Board and their effect on the progression and development of psychology. Okay, thank you.
Wow, my lucky day. Two voice feedbacks in the same show. Rick, thanks for those two suggestions. I'm not likely to turn either one into a whole show. I'm not sure I have enough older, returning students to merit a whole show on the topic. However, let me give you a quick hit about my own take on the issue. Over the years, I've taught a lot of returning students, some even older than 44. One thing is that these adult students often initially feel insecure about their academic abilities. They figure that they'll be up against all these sharp, young, 18-year-old whippersnappers. However, in truth, the returning students have it all over the younger ones in terms of maturity and motivation. They know why they are in school and what they want to get out of it, and often the younger ones aren't really sure of their direction, and they're there just because they have a sense that they're supposed to be there. And the older students, they've learned discipline and self-control, so they're able to buckle down and study instead of being constantly obsessed by the person they're dating or hoping to date. They also are a joy to their professors for that very reason. They're able to add a lot to class discussions because they've acquired a certain amount of confidence and because they have a lot of experience to draw upon. And they hope that their professors will give them material of real substance so they can be fairly demanding, while also respecting them for their own real-world experience. So, Rick, I say good for you. You keep right on marching toward that PhD, and you'll get it. I can't really speak to your second question because I'm not sure what review boards you're talking about, and again, I'm not sure that would be a topic of sufficiently widespread interest to devote a show to. But thanks again for listening and for leaving your questions on our voice line. Now let's go to some other listener feedback. One listener writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Thanks for all your hard work on Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel. I just started listening and am eagerly catching up on all the episodes. I'm a postdoctoral intern / psych assistant here in the Bay Area, and I'm always looking to learn more about psychology and different techniques. I'm also an avid proponent of family therapy and wanted to suggest a couple people that I think would be good to interview." And I think maybe I won't bother to read the people that he recommends, but they're good recommendations, and I have put them on my to-do list. So I want to thank you for that, Keith, who has a PsyD and who's doing postdoctoral work right now. I also got a nice note from Nir in New York City, who created the theme music that I'm currently using at the beginning and ending of each show. He also included a nice photo of himself at his keyboard synthesizer, nice kind of basement setup with lots of musical instruments and electronics, my kind of place. And he writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, congratulations for the birth of your granddaughter." Thank you very much. Says it was nice to hear the good news. "I also wanted to attach my picture just so you could get to know me a bit better, and I do appreciate that." And he says, "I have listened to the program about dealing with life and death. The point that made me respond was your question about the skeptics that say that the tunnel and light visions that are experienced near death are chemicals being released in the brain. It comes back to the point that Ken Wilber makes, that reality has four quadrants: I, it, we, its, meaning inner subjective I, experience, I, it, outer objective, observed I, chemicals in the brain that correspond to the inner experience, etc. When looking from the outside, one sees chemicals in the brain, but when experienced from the inside, the phenomenon is still very much valid, but it has to be communicated and interpreted, not just measured or observed. These are two dimensions of one thing, life experience. Nir. So Nir, as always, I thank you for your reflections on profound matters. I can always count on you for that. I have a number of other emails that I would love to read, but ever mindful of the time, I think I'll close it off for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and remember you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the website. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. You've already heard that you can leave messages using the MyChingo link on the website. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Fern W. Cohen for sharing her reflections as a psychoanalyst. And my next show will very likely feature Dr. Cohen again, with the two of us discussing the HBO series In Treatment. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Thank you.